This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast, our first podcast of 2019. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Happy New Year. Did you have a good one this year?
I did. Yeah, I was skiing. So beats a day in the office. No
Absolutely.
Offense, Peter.
Yeah, no, I was in the office. No, actually, we had a good New Year, good dinner, family, friends. It was really fun.
Good.
Really fun. But we're back. We're, pardon the pun, energized to go. So beyond being 2019, it is also the year of the
pig in the Chinese calendar, and it's certainly feeling that way.
It is. We got a number of topics to talk about. Of course, we're going to talk about the international move in the oil prices, and that'll distill down into our Canadian oil and gas markets.
Yep. Then we'll talk about what that means for the outlook for activity levels here in Canada and some other recent news that we thought was worth highlighting. I do want to come back to the year of the pig, though. It does feel that way. But in China, pigs are a sign of wealth and fortune. So let's just hope that the Chinese version comes through this year, not the Western view.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, some people have been listening to our podcasts exclusively just on our website, but you just have a different way of listening to things.
That's right. We posted something on our website about how to follow our podcast from your smartphone, which actually most of our users are actually listening on their computers. And the smartphone has lots of advantages. You can multitask. I'm always listening to podcasts when I'm doing household chores or working out or driving in my car. And so we'll put the link to how to do that on the bottom of the show notes here.
Right. So we should get out of the 1990s is what you're saying.
Yeah. Get into the new mobile age of audio on the go.
Good. Good. Well, international oil prices, what's going on there?
Okay, well, let's talk about West Texas Intermediate, which is the North American benchmark but follows the international price. It's kind of a bit of disbelief what happened here over the holidays, that prices just fell to $42. That was quite a good Christmas Eve present when I looked at my phone and saw that. So a lot of disbelief, especially because I wrote a commentary December 11 saying that the cut should keep the price above 50. So obviously the markets didn't read my commentary. Now, my logic was that if OPEC made these cuts, the market should be pretty supplied and we would still need some growth from the U.S. So we should have a floor around 50. But the good news is this week, price recovered to above $50.
So what's going on? I mean, it's not just about the OPEC cuts. We've got economic chatter going on, too. There was a lot of concern about the trade relationship between China and the United States, the ongoing trade war that's been happening. And it really, over the holidays, hit sort of a peak negativity. And when you have these trade uncertainties, it really affects the market's perception about GDP, and GDP relates to energy and oil consumption. And the perception was that that was really going south. That's reversed now.
Well, I don't know if it has, but yes, there's some trade negotiations going on between U.S. and China, and there's a view that there will be some resolution to the trade war and more trade. But I just want to come back and say, you know, as an oil analyst, I don't see this demand issue as anything close to the supply issue. And the reason I would say that is most agencies, including the World Bank that just came out this week, think that economic growth in 2019 may be about 0.2% lower than 2018, and that China's still going to grow like, you know, over 6%, and that the advanced economies are going to be slightly impacted, like 0.1 or 0.2% down. And so when you look at this, there's not much of an impact to oil demand here.
No, that's the reality of the situation. And we talked about that in an earlier podcast from last year. But the markets really do get concerned at any hint of economic slowdown on a global basis. And the oil price has always responded to that, which is why we call the oil business a cyclical business, because the dominant cyclical driver is the economy. And so when there's negative pull on top of the economy, typically oil prices are quite reactive on the downside and vice versa. And so this ongoing saga of the trade war is really introducing volatility, and then draped over that, we have the saga on the supply side and the uncertainties of what OPEC is going to do or not going to do, what the Iran sanctions are going to do or not going to do, and so on and so forth. So it all adds up to pretty big price swings.
Well, yeah. And, you know, let's talk about this OPEC deal. So Saudi, you know, recognizing the price was sliding, has put out a lot of messaging in the last few weeks about these are real. One of the things is there was some doubts because there wasn't country level targets that these would actually be done. Now, Saudi's actually maybe probably going to overcut. They're talking about having a cut that's almost as big as the whole OPEC cut here in January.
Wow.
And so I actually think these cuts are going to come in bigger than we think. The market's going to balance faster than we think. But I guess the market has to see that.
Right. And so the price has responded favorably to that?
It has. And I think, to your point, the biggest reason for the move this week might have been just news around this U.S.-China trade war resolution and the potential for the economy not to be as impacted.
So the price dropped, as we know, in the latter part of the year. Very close to Christmas, as you said, into the low 40s. Did we see any sort of response in the United States in terms of the drilling activity? I mean, it was happened so quickly. But I mean, what is the sentiment in terms of U.S. activity and output production into 2019?
Well, right now it's looking like the U.S. will still grow in terms of their spending next year, maybe in the range of 5 or 10%. But that's less growth than the previous year, where it was around 20%.
Wow.
So there's still going to be growth, but there is a view that the supply won't grow as much. But that's mainly of a function of infrastructure bottlenecks out of the Permian.
Right.
So we're only expecting about 1 million barrels a day of growth out of the U.S. this year compared to something like 1.4 in 18. That's kind of entry to exit.
So there's a lot of moving parts here. And what is our best expectation of what's going to emerge here, say, in the first half of the year and the latter half of the year?
I'm going to stick with my view, assuming no other big surprises here, that price should stay above $50 a barrel. I think OPEC will cut. I think that will mean that we do need to have prices that incent some supply growth from the U.S., which I believe we know we need prices above 50 bucks to do that. So I think we should see a fairway that's 50 and above.
50 and above is a reasonable price, especially when you multiply it by the exchange rate here in Canada. And so let's talk about the Canadian oil and gas markets. Obviously, the drama and trauma of what was happening in November, December with our price differentials was top of the news. And following the production curtailment announcement of the provincial government in mid-December, we have now seen the differential recover significantly.
Oh, yeah. Like the differentials have been literally crushed.
Yeah.
We had differentials for heavy oil, the difference between the crude price in Cushing, Oklahoma, WTI, and here in Canada at like $30 different for light crude. And now that's like $3. And heavy oil used to be $50, and now it's like $9. Like, big change.
Wow. Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk with a light differential first. So this would be our Edmonton Light, our premium grade here. Typically, that would trade what?
It's typically around 4 or 5. And that basically that comes from just the quality of the two products, WTI and our crude, are fairly similar. So that just covers the transportation cost to get between here and there. And so actually, it's even more narrow than what would cover the transportation costs.
Right.
So a little bit narrower than we've seen over the historical.
So that's good news. Almost normal, in fact, a little bit better than normal. And we have on the heavy side, you said we went from $50 down to
$9 right now on the spot market.
Right, right. So what is, I mean, this is an area that I see of significant confusion. Now we have the television reports and things, you know, talking about the Western Canadian Select or this heavy oil differential narrowing and narrowing. There seems to be an expectation that it should narrow all the way to the West Texas intermediate price, but that's not where the normal average differential should be, is it?
No, no. Normally it would be around $15 if you just look at the theory, and the theory would be look at the transportation cost, which I just talked about, around $4 a barrel. 4 or 5, and then there's a quality difference. So our heavy oil from the oil sands is not the same quality as that light crude in Texas. And refiners actually have to spend a lot more money to turn it into refined products, so they pay less for it.
Right. So Western Canadian Select, by virtue of where it is and where it has to go to, the transportation cost, plus the quality of where it is and where it has to be refined up to, means that it should be about $15 less than WTI?
Yeah, in theory.
$15.
And so we're below that. So
we're $9 less. So
right.
we're actually getting a premium to where it should be.
Yeah. So I would say at this point, you know, in the near market, we actually have in the futures market a little bit wider differentials. But right now, can't expect differentials better than this.
So they are so wide because the cuts are likely to be potentially more than expected, the 325,000.
That, you know, I think that is what's going on here. It is a bit of a mystery why they're so narrow, because we should still need some crude to leave the province by rail. But if the cuts were larger, then that would mean not as much rail and we could support these narrow differentials. And so I believe that the cuts will be a bit bigger than maybe what was initially put out there as by the province of 8.7% cut. We might see a larger cut, and therefore we don't need as much rail, and therefore we don't need the diffs to be as wide in the near term.
Right. So let's just review this. We've got 4 million barrels a day, roughly, of production. The province comes in to alleviate the glut, says you got to cut by 8.7%, about 325,000 barrels per day off of the 4 million. As it turns out, the market and observers and analysts are looking at the situation and saying, oh, you know what? It might be actually greater than 325,000 that is going to be shut in by virtue of number of dynamics. So therefore, our differentials have narrowed very quickly. In fact, have narrowed to the point where they're trading at a premium to where they should be.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Now, I don't think that's going to stick around for the whole year because the province has talked about slowly removing these curtailments, and you will need rail, not just pipeline, to move crude from Western Canada. And in order to support rail, you will need differentials that pay for the transportation costs,
right,
which is
right,
higher.
Right.
So I don't think it's going to stick around forever. But the good news is, even in the long term, you know, it's not $50 differential. If you look in the futures market out a year, you know, it's more like a $18 differential. So it's a lot narrower than it was.
Yeah, it strikes me that they may actually relieve the curtailment sooner than later. Is what probably might happen here. I mean, this is not an exact science, right? I mean, it's a little bit like putting your hand on a radio dial, you know, turning it up and down and trying to find the right level. It's the same thing here. I mean, we've had such dislocations and disruptions in the Western Canadian oil markets that finding the right balance and getting that sense of balance back over the longer term is going to take some tweaking.
I think so. And the thing to watch will be these inventory levels.
Right.
And, you know, seeing that they start to draw down will be what everyone will be looking for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, as I said, the drama and the trauma of November and December, those extremely debilitating differentials, which led to oil prices that were like $10 on the heavy, $20 on the lights, did leave us with companies that all of a sudden completely shut their wallets and said, we're not spending anymore.
Yeah, and I don't blame them. When you've got that level of uncertainty in terms of what your production might be,
right,
with the talk of the curtailments, but also what, you know, how much cash you're going to have because the prices are very volatile,
yeah,
a lot of companies just choose to do nothing. And I think we're seeing that in terms of the activity rates as we come into the new year being much lower than they were the same time last year.
So we've got a little bit of a divergence here. We've got activity rates that are very low. We're coming into the year 2019, similar to 2016, which was a debilitating year, where the price of oil had dropped to $35. So that is a little bit at odds with the most recent price movements, with those differentials narrowing to premium levels,
mm-hmm,
plus the top line oil price recovering back to the $50 level or so. So there's a bit of a dislocation. So what are you hearing about the producers and if they're going to spend and start drilling again?
Well, you know, this is a year where picking the activity rate, which is something we love to do here at ARC, every year we like to figure out how many wells we might be drilling in the upcoming year. It's more challenging because we don't have, I think, that much guidance that we can rely on. Yes, a lot of companies have put out guidance, but it's quite dated and things have changed a lot. So I think there's some downside risk to it. If you look at the industry as a whole, a lot of the public companies, it might indicate that spending would be down about 10%. However, a lot of these are dated. If I look at the most recent big announcement, CNRL is saying they're going to spend about 20% less in 2019 compared to 18.
Significant.
Yeah, and 7Gen this week came out saying down 27% year on year. And so, you know, I think those most recent ones are probably a little more reflective of what companies are thinking than some of the more dated ones.
Yeah, so what's actually being seen in the field in terms of the number of rigs that are active, which is quite low for this time of year. It's like 180 rigs or something like
that. Yeah, 180. We would have had near 300 this time last year. So that's, you know, 40% or so down.
Right. And the public company guidance, which typically came out after the end of the third quarter of last year, is stale.
That's right.
And we are probably going to be waiting for the company guidance to come out after the board meetings that are going to happen over the course of the next few weeks.
So you're expecting that real guidance from more of the companies might be revised February
timeframe? Yeah, they're going to be interesting boardroom discussions because, as I said, we've seen an improvement in pricing, both international and domestic. And that has to be paired against the general feeling of unease and uncertainty and the episode that we just came through, which was quite severe in terms of the price shocks. So I think we're going to see cautious spending this year. I think that the CNRL, 7Gen, and other companies that have issued guidance very recently, you know, down 20% is probably not unrealistic, certainly for the first half.
Right, but and not then, the down the 40% that we're seeing right now.
No, I think it's going to improve a bit. I think it's going to improve, and yeah. I think, you know, the view you expressed on international oil prices potentially firming up a little bit into the second half of the year. Of course, that's very dependent upon economic outlooks and so on. But the second half is probably going to look better than the first half. And by the way, in the second half, we'll also have more of that railroad stuff and longer-term remedies to the market access issue.
Right. So more spending, probably more weighted towards the second half of the year, which is very different for Canada.
Yeah.
Usually like a third of our drilling is in the winter. Then this first quarter of the year, that's probably not going to happen this year, but we'll still probably see some spending later on.
I think that's what you're going to see.
Okay, well, let's talk about some other news, recent news that's worth highlighting. In Canada this week, there was a lot of talk about this opposition to the LNG pipeline that is going to connect the gas fields in Northeast BC with the LNG Canada project in Kitimat. And the news coverage was because a First Nation group that is opposing the project had set up these barriers and were not allowing construction workers. So 14 people were arrested. There was some protests in a number of cities across Canada about the removal of this blockade and a lot of press coverage. Now, there was an agreement reached yesterday, and the group will now take down these barriers and allow the construction workers access, although they don't support the project, they say still.
Yeah, now, this is a very complicated situation. You know, I've spent quite a bit of time in this area over the last several years on the pipeline trail, as I like to call it, and it's really tough. And the problem is that there really isn't a defined rule of law. Now, I know from a Canadian perspective, there is rule of law and so on, but from the perspective of the First Nations, especially groups like the Wet'suwet'en, their perception of rule of law is very different from the national perception. And this leads to all sorts of problems. So, you know, one has to look at the situation sympathetically to a certain degree. But at the end of the day, leadership does have to emerge to resolve the situation. That's where we're at. But I think at the root of it, you know, certainly what I learned when I was there is that engagement at a community level is so important by industry, by other stakeholders that want to get these projects built. You have to develop the trust of the people along the way. And it's a long-term proposition. Because it's, although the rule of law is one thing, of course, we're all human and we need to be able to establish commonality in terms of goals and so on. And I think clearly the protests show that that commonality has not been achieved.
Well, you know, the one thing I'll say is that, and this is just about the media coverage, I agree with you, Peter, but the media coverage, I think, made it sound like this sort of represents everybody. But the reality is something like 25 First Nations have signed agreements with the pipeline company, the Coastal Link LNG Pipeline, which TransCanada, but they have a new name this week.
TC Energy.
Yeah, TC Energy. Okay, well, that's a whole other topic. But they've got support from these groups. And even this band, the Wet'suwet'en, they have agreed to this, but there's a sub group here that hasn't.
Well, that's right, because again, I'll say it again, like the rule of law is not clear. The 1997 Delgamuque case that was established in the Supreme Court of Canada left enough ambiguity in terms of who has jurisdiction over these sorts of things that this is going back and forth and there's no clear resolution. Now, I am far from an expert on the legalities and constitutional law and Aboriginal Indigenous issues, but I can tell you, having been there, it is not clear on the ground, actually, who has jurisdiction over being able to sign a contract and say that, yes, we as a peoples agree to this, because First Nations in plural means that there is many, many groups. I think there's over 50 First Nations just in British Columbia. And within those First Nations, there are different power structures, and it is very difficult to really understand how all of this works.
Okay. Yeah, and I get that, right? You're saying that not everyone agrees to the group that signed the agreement.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so we are in an era where small groups of people, whether they're Indigenous or whether they're civic on, you know, Burnaby or wherever, that doesn't like a project, whatever that project might be, can band together and organize a protest.
Okay, but I want to hit on that word small, because this is where I have the issue with the media coverage. I think it should be more balanced to represent all the voices, more representative of the people that are for it and against it. So most of the coverage at the beginning of this week was just sort of focusing on this group of people and their issues, but not sort of talking about, you know, all the people that do support it in the area and trying to bring some balance. Here's an example. You know, a lot of coverage of these protests to support the people that were removed from the blockade. These protests had, some of them had 100 people, some of them less than 100 people. Meanwhile, there's been a lot of pro-pipeline protests, especially over the Christmas holidays here in Western Canada. Many of them were measured in thousands of people. We had Rocky Mountain House, 1,000 people, White Court, over 1,000 vehicles, Calgary, 2,700 people. And they didn't get very much media focus. So I think when the media wants to show something, they should show the balance. Yes, there are people that are against this project, but also there are a lot of people that are for it, and we should try to share the airtime.
Yeah, I can agree with you that we need to share the airtime more, but I also think that more effort needs to be put by stakeholders, including the industry, on really working with these communities on the ground, whether they're Indigenous or not.
It's a great point. And to come back to how this all got resolved, we did actually have the Coastal Link group make an agreement, come meet with them, and now they have agreed to remove the barriers. So that is actually what happened.
You know, we should never allow it to get to that, is my view. And I know that more can be done. And I'm hoping that as we go forward, that these are lessons that we learn, that it's really important to emphasize the on-the-ground community engagement. As I said again, whether it's Indigenous communities or non-Indigenous municipal communities and so on.
Yeah. We're in 2019 now. You know, people care about these projects.
They
want to understand them.
Sure.
We need more consultation.
Sure.
We need more people involved. That's what
that's
what society's demanding.
That's right.
Okay, let's talk a little bit news on Trans Mountain Pipeline this week. Now, the NEB has issued draft conditions related to the marine safety and marine mammal protection. So if you remember, we had the court decision there in the summer that said, you know, the approval was getting pulled back because there were two issues. One was around First Nations consultation and one was around this marine issue. So this is the draft resolution to the marine issue. And basically what they're urging is that there are some limits put in place around marine traffic because of the orcas in the area.
So this is not just about oil tankers.
No, it's not. And in fact, the interesting part is the NEB initially scoped this out because they said this was broader than the project and they actually didn't have the jurisdiction to make rules about all shipping traffic.
Right.
But this is actually going to affect all shipping traffic and they need to reduce the noise associated with the ships and that will help the
orca. You mean the underwater noise?
Underwater noise. And to do that, you actually go slower. There's been some pilots done in the area this summer that by going slower, you reduce the underwater noise and less disturbance to marine mammals.
So give us a sense of the numbers, like how many ships go in and out of Vancouver? I don't even know. Is it...
I know. Okay. So you're in luck. So, you know, it's a bit dated, but this is the only data that I've been able to find. It was part of the regulatory filings for the TMX. So it was work that was done in 2012, but there was also a projection done into the future. But in 2012, there's about 5,500 large vessels traveling in the area, and only 60 of those were from the Trans Mountain Project. The forecast is it would be about 6,200 when the TMX comes online. And that there would be 400 tankers. So about 6.6% of all of the traffic was projected to be coming from the Trans Mountain Project. The rest would be other shipping things, whether it be like cargo ships or other tankers with refined products or other products like coal and sulfur.
Okay, so let me try and understand this. So we got 5,500 ships going in and out of Vancouver a year in 2012.
Yeah.
Right. And that number is expected to grow to 6,200, including all sorts of freighters and cruise ships and what have you.
Yes.
Right. In 2012, Trans Mountain tankers were 60. If the pipeline gets built, 408 per year. Right. So the fraction of tankers from Trans Mountain to total ships is going to increase, but the Department of, the National Energy Board, is basically saying that all ships, freighters, et cetera, and otherwise are part of the problem here.
Yeah, including they're putting some potential limits on the whale watching industry because those guys that go out and chase the whales around are pretty disruptive.
Everything is disruptive in the water with a big propeller. Okay, so what does this mean in terms of the timeline for Trans Mountain?
Well, this is a draft, and so there is some time to comment, and then there would be a final report in February with some recommendations or conditions that would be added to the existing approval. So there'll be more conditions, and you know, not all of them, I guess, TMX could actually do unilaterally if it involves changes to the whole marine shipping.
Right. So what are we driving toward here? We've got the recommendations, and then at some point there needs to be another ruling.
There would be some new recommendations, but then we'd still have the First Nations consultation that hasn't been done yet. Mm-hmm. And so we're still waiting on that. There's no date right now in terms of when that would wrap up, but that's the other piece of the puzzle that's needed. And once you have those, then the project can get back on track again.
Get back on track with the shovels in the ground.
Okay, well, we've covered a lot of ground on Canada and the oil markets and the outlook for activity. Tune in, by the way, for our next podcast, which is going to be on the renewables market. There's actually been a lot going on in Alberta, Canada, and beyond in renewables. So we wanted to look at 2018 and look back at it and talk about some of the major developments. So we're going to have a guest, Grant Arnold from Blue Earth, which is a generator.
Yeah, looking forward to that one. Well, thanks everyone for listening, and we'll join you next week.
Thank you.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.